carol begins with a reference to Luther's commentary on St. Paul's epistle to the Romans.
I wish very much we had it in the village. We don't seem to. Somebody's run away with the last three volumes of the five-volume Holman, and I better get mine out here. I hadn't given mine simply because we did have a gift of it. And it's in there, and somehow, I'd wring Jerry Pelican's neck if you're here right now. Why it isn't in all those volumes they've already got out, I don't know, because in our English-speaking world, that goof-off research scholar, this is the big impact on English-speaking world, because that's what converted John Wesley, you see, at Aldergate's mission when some gal read it, and we got the Methodist Church, for one thing. And it's had a tremendous impact on the thinking about Luther and Lutheran theology within the English-speaking world, together with your commentary on Galatians, which got fortunately translated way back in the 16th century decently enough. So it's been a fantastic impact on the English-speaking world, not least through Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress. And though there he misses one glorious thing Luther has, which Bunyan, I'm afraid, has to be faulted for, and J.B. Phillips does, in that cold, dark stream through which we must go before we trumpets are on the other side. Because for Luther, one thing Luther scored for is that death for him is the final sanctifier. You drag this old Adam with you like a dumb ox to the grave, but finally I'm dead and whoopee. You know, so it's hardly something that you dread in the sense of the final enemy, because in Jesus Christ has been overcome, and he that lives and believes in Jesus Christ shall never die. And that's there too, see? And Luther never forgot it. He's an exciting person. That's the thing. He is unquestionably what John Berryman called him in his opening lecture for his lectures at the University of Minnesota on Western civilization. He started by requiring all of them to read the Gospel of Mark. He said, you can't understand what's happened in Western society without knowing the Gospel of Mark. And then the Jewish boys would all have their hands in the air. How can we read that? Because he said, you can't read any book unless you take the premise of the author and reading it. You don't understand unless you accept the premises. You can't be fighting in the author. Let's understand the author and then let's argue with him. You know. So how can we do this? After all, the beginning of the Gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. He says, that's your problem in Western society. And this is right, it is. It is their problem. And we've been speaking to that this week. It's a very real one. And we're very sympathetic with them on it. And Jesus says, every word spoken against the Son of Man will be forgiven you, fortunately. And we've got that word from our Lord, but this still there is an issue. Then he went on to say that one of your big shocks is going to discover that all Western society has as its fulcrum and pivot the most strange and exciting person in the history of the human race. And his name is Martin Luther. His misfortune is that he fell into the hands of the Lutherans. And that's true. By the way, that is true. I mean, he's speaking as a poet, but he's also speaking as a very penetrating, sensitive spirit to what's happening in Western society, not least at this moment. For example, who of you in the Lutheran Church have ever heard this one? And I'll just take from Lawrence Durrell, Nunquam the Second. Ad Hunc was the first of a two-volume thing that he's got in showing the crushing of the human spirit within the corporation kind of society of modern business. It's a brilliant novel, because you read the Alexandrian Quartet and me never turned to it. This ain't sexy in the same way, although this brother's finally got modern science to build him an exact duplicate who can function in every way as this actress whom he was in love with that couldn't stand him. But meanwhile, she's committed suicide, and now he's got this phony little deal, and part of the climax is when the phony one that's rubber and can function every way like the actress did walks off a balcony. And he dives after her. Well, that's Lawrence Durrell. But here's the theme for the book. Here's the theme for the book, and you haven't heard this in your Lutheran church, except apologetically maybe somebody's mentioned along the line that after all Luther would not be a very good friend for capitalism, but we won't bring that up, you know. Calvin is, of course, the guy to whom we give credit for developing our capitalist society, not Luther. Luther's an old backwoodsman, he thought a patriarchal society was possible. You've heard that maybe. All right, let's listen to him here and see if you don't have to read the quartets of a famous guy that we said he was crazy because he was not all in favor of us during the war and stayed down there in Italy and got put in an insane asylum and was not permitted to get great honor that came to him as a great poet. But his quartets take through this thing called, what's the big word? Usury. 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 Remember those deals he's got going on usury. We won't go into that. I don't want to throw any more names in it. I can't. But here's the theme for this. Two-volume novel. This is how contemporary is. Not Luella Parsons, but the other gal that does everything on the movies. Was griping, why can't we get a decent Protestant movie? All these sappy Protestant movies with sentimentality. Another one had just come out after World War II. She says, after all, we got an exciting guy for a movie, Luther. She says, or is he still too hot to handle after 400 years? He's too hot to handle. Here's what she says. I've been studying the demonic of our capitalistic system through the eyes of Luther, a chastening experience in some ways. He saw the final coming to power in this world of Satan as a capitalistic emblem. For him, the entire structure of the kingdom of Satan is essentially capitalistic. We are the devil's own real property, he says. And his deepest condemnation of our system is his phrase, quote, "Money is the word of the devil, through which he creates all things in exactly the way God once created the true word," end quote. In his devastating theology, capitalism manifests itself as the ape of God. He calls him Simia Dei. Satan's always aping God. Satan has his saints. You've seen this now in Galatians, and it's fascinating, isn't it? You got a white devil in there. He's a nice guy, and these are nice people. And he says, how Satan weeps when one of them falls into some open sin. See? Yeah. Oh, it's great. Great, see? Here he's the ape of God, the Simia Dei. It's hard to look objectively at oneself in the shaving mirror once one has ventured with this maniac through the modern sock of the real shared world. This is a German word which he's taking up, which is the colon and what goes through of the real shared world. This extended worm bag of a place out of which squirm all our cultural and gnomic patterns. Gnomic are the presuppositions that are in our proverbs that we take for granted. Early to bed, early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise, you know, etc. I mean, the things we just take for granted, it's the real truth. Learned it as a proverb when you were a kid. Okay, that's what gnomic means, these gnomic patterns. A gnomic aorist is an aorist that covers all of history in one little statement like that. The stinking end god of a world whose convulsions are simply due to the putrefying explosions of fecal gas in the intestines of time. Well, that's a poetic way of what Luther would say, that big fart. And Luther would say it. See, and he does. His language is deplorable and great. You never get bored. Read just his he's got a whole book of sermons down here, 14th chapter of John. Read it down there. He uses a manure pile all the way through. He gets everything out of that manure pile you can get out of a manure pile. For Luther, everything was there to be used. Use it. God's speaking through it. See? He paused, musing, shaking his head. And then gold itself, as Spengler points out, is not really a color, for colors are natural things. No, that metallic greenish gleam is of a satanic unearthliness, yet it has an explicit mystical value in the iconography of our churches. Interesting, see? So on. And then from gold to money is only a very short jump, but a jump which spans the shallow trench of our whole culture and offers us some sort of rationale for the megalopolitan men we are in our ways. Our ways! For money is the beating heart of the new word and the power of money to bear interest. Its basic raison d'etre has created the big city around it. Want to read this? Read Jacques Ellul, where he has this article on the city and then his book on the city from the Bible. That's contemporary at the same moment on that same thing. Money is the dynamo throwing out its waves and impulse in the interest principle, and without this volatility principle of Satan's gold, there would have been no cities. The archaeologists will tell you that they have noted the completest rupture of the lifestyle of man once he has founded his first cities and so on. In other words, what you yourself, you dare track to hear what you come. The village is a hope of the future, and that we can find villages within our cities. If we can't, we are going to be of all men most miserable, because we have to relate in interpersonal relations, and our dependency needs have to find support within those from each other, or we are crushed, and Satan's got us. Okay, now when you were reading the commentary to Galatians, if you've read it at all thoroughly, there's certainly not. Like Luther says, I don't ask anybody to follow me in this. I'm way too verbose. He is. He's throwing out words like crazy. But he also has to speak as I do. I speak as 20th century man. He speaks as 15th, 16th century man. You can't jump out of your skin. And Luther can't skip out of his. The Renaissance is there, and the revival of language is the beginning of every revival in the church. This is Luther's statement, and it's true. And you'll see it very clearly, as we'll discuss a little wee bit, because I'm studying now before my trip to London for 8 days, the Reformation in England. It begins with the excitement about languages. And these guys that get converted to the gospel get converted because of their excitement over the new translations, in the Greek New Testament. But Luther is a Renaissance man, and you see this at moments in his commentary on Galatians. For instance, I don't think any 20th scholar who has been with this problem can possibly follow Luther on Ta stoicheia tou kosmo, which he makes fundamental first principles. In modern Greek, it's ghosts. In ancient Greek, it's the demonic powers that control your life independent of your will because of the stars that you're born under. Well, Melanchthon writes the preface for Copernicus' thing, and Luther thinks nobody's going to be so stupid as to go to astrology. We got a new day. It's Renaissance. Who's going to ever think something born under some star is going to determine? He doesn't translate it that way. See, he translates fundamental first principles. It's possible to do this out of the idea ABC comes out of it, but it has the idea of a specific kind of orderliness of the world that's determined by the planets and their course. You know when they're going to come. You can predict, you see, every time of year where the planets are, etc. And the ancients believed then it depended on what planet was where and what constellation, what planets to what you were. Now, nobody in the 20th century naturally would be so stupid as to go along with any kind like that, and that's why Luther changed that, you see. You're all laughing somehow, huh? I'm a 20th century man. I'm well aware of why you're laughing. Luther would have been astounded to get up to the top of the Empire State Building and find out you could get your astrology for a quarter out of a machine. And that if the thing you cut out of our newspapers, they put it amongst the ads, is what's going to happen to you today if you happen to be whatever you are. I've had people come up here and, no wonder you like me. You are something, aren't you? And I said, what am I? And I'd look at, I said, well, you're, I don't know, Aries or whatever it is, you are, Leo. And I'd say, I don't know what I am, but I'm born December. Oh, no, then you can't like me because you're something. I was just listening. No. When I was in L.A., for a few moments it was on, I had to shut it off. It was so demanding. Two very charming, obviously one of them might have been Norwegian Swede. She was that good looking. I'm sure she was in the American scene. But these two girls were the guy in between, and they were answering questions. And they said, you can't expect these two children in your home to get along. They'll always fight because people born as an Aries or Leo or whatever it was, they'll always fight. They never get along. Imagine telling a mother that about her kids. I mean, what kids ever do get along? Why do they have to go back to that? The reason why God calls brothers and sisters is because we fight. We're still brothers and sisters, and that's the way it is in every family. And that should be what they'd said. A little gospel in on the picture, see? Because all you've got on that other side is demonic. And so we quote, I mean, in your New English today, and in your RSV and so on, unfortunately, the New Jerusalem still got caught with old Luther at this point, and they still translate over there under fundamental principles. But it is demonic powers. Luther's very clear on demonic powers. Nobody's been more clear on him. You see this as he sees it in interest and capital and what money does to us in destroying us. But the demonic nature of existence, Luther saw. He saw it as under law and under guilt. Under that sign, humanity becomes destroyed. It's impossible. But he didn't see it as under what star you were born. See? But when you think something other than your response freely to this gospel, this word from the Lord, that something else determines that response than you, then that's demonic. You can't be a Christian because you're something called a... What's the goat one? That's what I'm born under, I think. And most like a goat, at least. Is that what's in December? I always thought a fella should have been born under the sign of a goat, huh? Well, okay, that's... Anyway, these are not where you're at, you see. It's your shape by your response to that which comes to you in existence. Out of your human relationships and your time and so on. That's one point. In other words, we don't follow him in Galatians. There's another where I think he's sadly Renaissance and he misses it. I think he underplays Paul here and doesn't see the power of this particular example. He wasn't happy by the time he got to 34 in those lectures, 33, 32 in Galatians. He certainly has thrown aside allegorizing completely. In the early lectures in Romans, he's still over there using it as a tool. And Paul, I'm specifically used the word allegory about that incident in the fourth chapter on Sarah and Hagar. Though Paul used the word allegory, it's not allegory in that sense of meaning whatever. The word has the idea of image, the shaping image, is what we would say today. This is the shaping image of our life together in the new covenant, that Sarah wants to save God's face, and so she says, well, Abraham's been looking a certain word, Hagar, who isn't aware of how he looked at people like that, and she said, I guess I better be more generous as a wife and say God intended that he should have a son, certainly, to fulfill God's promise, and I ought to be big enough to let him have one by Hagar. And so she runs ahead instead of waiting on the God of the promise, and what you got is a bastard instead of a son. And the son of Hagar is in contention with the son of Sarah that finally comes under the promise, for the children of the law always contend with the children of the gospel. Why don't we see that in every congregation wherever we are? They always have, they always will. And that's a symbol of our whole relationship under the new covenant. Luther said, Paul's already convinced every reasonable person. But now there are certain children in their imagination that need an illustration. So he says it's like a man who builds a house and he puts a picture on the wall. And now he tells this little picture about Hagar. No, no, no. It's like you build a house for the view. See? This is the view. This is the waiting upon the God of the promise. It finally comes there. And now Paul says, we, brethren, are children of the free women. And he feels he's finally claimed them after he said that. See, and he goes on in that spirit. For freedom, Christ has set us free. Don't throw it away again, so on he goes on. And there again, Luther thwarts, I think, Paul in what Paul is seeing out of the whole Old Covenant relationship to the New Covenant literature and the New Covenant thrust. Luther is an Old Testament exegete primarily. Go down and look at all those books on we got down there already from Jerry Pelican on Genesis. I have them all in Latin, and they went in the flood, and I didn't weep over it. But that's what Luther spent most of his time in the Old Testament. He's fundamentally an Old Testament exegete. Simply because he felt Jesus was fundamentally that, which he was. And unless we see the New Testament in the context of the Old Testament, we aren't seeing it. And Luther believed this, but here he misses it at this point. See? And under the Old Covenant image of Hagar and Sarah, we see our whole waiting upon the God, the promise, the new, and so on. Now, I think that there you can take the discoverer of Mark as a pericope in a series of sermons, one of our great New Testament scholars in this century, who does see in his little commentary on this particular letter of Galatians, that at this moment what we have, and that's Carl Friedrich, what's his last name, Mary, over at Basel. My goodness. I'm so tired out, and I've been running so much, I had to go up and change before I came down here, and I was just soaking wet, and that's part of my problem lecturing you today. Well, I'll bring you the word later, but this really great scholar, Bo Reiki from up there at Lund, has replaced him. And it's the top New Testament chair, really. And he has said that, now, Paul has said, aporiumai, I'm without any way with you. That's the last word Paul just said before he starts his illustration. I don't know how to get through to you people. He says, aren't you hearing the law? You're hearing it all the time. And this is what the law says. See. Now, the scholar says, finally, he gets through. He feels that he's picking him up under the law of apperceptivity, with his hearing of the law. And what the law says is if you're under the law, you're through, because that's what Hagar was. See, but Sarah is under the promise, and she's the one through whom the promised seed comes. And this is the way we have to see that. Schmidt, I think his last name is. But we're in an area, in other words, when we read Luther, we read him as 20th century people. But it's still true, as old Berggraf said at one of our first Lutheran World Federation meetings after World War II, and Niegren had a lecture on the same thing, our problem isn't the fact that we're hung with Luther, we haven't caught up with him. And that's generally true through this. But you still have to, as you are saying, you're not taken captive by him, you're taken captive by Jesus Christ. But you're taken captive by a guy who's exciting and fun, and who said of himself, he says, I lost Jesus amongst the scholastics, I found him again in Paul. And yet he wouldn't have gone so far as to say, like Ambrose did, that Paul was Jesus' other eye, because the Lord Jesus is there all the time. And that's what he sees in Paul. Like he says in that wonderful statement that I used in that Gothic lettering for one of our releases one year in a calendar, that the name of Jesus is never absent from the Apostle Paul, as though were he absent but a moment, then would come despair. And, you know, it just starts off Galatians, every line, Jesus Christ, practically. And there's where Luther sees us, being taken captive by him. Now, we have a truncated Luther in more ways than just these little brief things that I'm saying. Philip Watson would like to come here. I found him inadequate to this place in the kind of intense give and take that we have in argumentation and discussion, because he gets uptight and on the defensive with as very benign and PR guy as Daryl Lundby. Daryl Lundby actually managed to get him mad. I couldn't believe it. First time I ever seen Daryl make anybody mad. I thought, boy, Watson, if you're that uptight, you're uptight. And the person who alerted me to this was our black from Missouri Synod. Can you think of his name?
Will
Hertzfeld. That he thought we couldn't have him here because he was too uptight, and he is. I'd love to have him here because he is aware that he's been guilty of giving you a half Luther. And it's a brilliant study. It's a good book. I certainly want all of you to read it as you're part of this now. Well, I've thrown them all down here. Come on, here you are. Let God Be God is the title of a very fine introduction. Now, just happens that during World War II, absolute uptight screwball by the name of Lord Vansittart blames Hitler on Luther, blames Luther for Hitler. It's during World War II. All of our Lutherans sit back and take it. Nobody rises to Luther's defense, except two Methodists in England, E. Gordon Rupp and Philip Watson. We got two Methodists who've written two brilliant books, just showing how far off you guys are in the trouble with the English-speaking world and English church that we've never seen Luther and who he is anyway. See, the one thing he could never produce is a Hitler, anything but, in spite of all of the Garys that are there and some anti-Semitism that comes in his later life and so on, because Luther feels like all of us do in our generation, finally the Jews are going to get converted. And then when they weren't, he got a little mad, you know. You aren't going to be converted, you're going to be converted. You know, and there was a little of that Luther too, he's all human. This let God be God, as Philip Watson said, should have had another, the other half of Luther, let man be man. And he's an astute guy, he's sensitive, and we're talking to him, and he says, everything I know and have heard about Holden Village, you've captured both sides of Luther there, and we have, see. This place has got him complete, he's here. We got him in spirit and we got him in body. and both sides should have been there. So we've got a half Luther, in a sense. The other great Methodist, Gordon Rupp, that wrote The Righteousness of God, has got a little different approach, and a very, very good one. He is trying to make the English-speaking world just aware of what's been happening in the scholarship world. He says of a fellow that I'm not too fond of, Einar Moland, about doing this. He asked Einar Moland, can any Englishman actually write a good book about Martin Luther? And he said, no. Well, Einar Moland, that goof off, he goes off skiing when they're having worship on Sunday morning, so I'm not that fond of him, and I've had some arguments. He's never answered my arguments to him in paper, because he's one of these guys that thinks Norway and Sweden are somehow the millennium, which they fall a little short of being. But the relationship of the English-speaking world to Luther is a very inadequate one, and that is, as Time and Newsweek have both lamented in their religious columns, one reason why our preaching is so foul ball. I mean, we get so much moralism, so much man-centered approach from the church, so little excitement in proclamation, and as a beautiful hour on TV by the then president of the United Nations, that Lebanese guy that I'm wondering how he's getting along right now, dear guy, Malik, was the tragedy of American Christianity and its emotionalism that has forsaken the God of the sacraments, so we're always looking to our feelings and how am I doing, instead of to the act of God in baptism in the Lord's Supper where he's laid hold of us in Jesus Christ, and to the laying on of hands from one another that assures you that you're in and beloved and wanted for Christ's sake. Because that's what it's all about, and that's what American Christianity is such a hard time getting, because it thinks you've got to be emotionalized and hear a Billy Graham and have a big rally and sing some songs about, I got that piece of God that passes understanding down in my heart, you see. And then you got it made, see. But you, and Luther busts that one all to bits. Not that he can't speak strongly about these feelings and about his own and that they belong, but you never put your confidence there. It's always on the cross and from the cross and a Christ for me that gets the emphasis, because then everything else will happen. Everything else will happen if you keep that there. You can't keep people from the faith if you've got that there, see? And that's, of course, what it proved up, because John Wesley has been running all over here amongst the Indians, preaching to him back and forth, trying to find this feeling of being in and with it, and doesn't come, and then he happens to wander into chapel on Aldersgate with a woman preacher reading a preface to Romans, and he gets converted. And Charles Wesley, fortunately, got it out of the commentary to the Galatians, so we get those beautiful hymns that are shaped by that, because John didn't get into Luther. He really doesn't quite see him, and these Methodists are very frank about that, and why, and how he misses it, because he gets a little scared of this gospel. You've got to tie it down, see. And that's why they get to be called Methodists, see, tying it down. Have you had the same experience I am? Okay, what day were you converted? You know the hour? You know, that sort of thing. Well, there's a certain power in it, but it's terrible, because it's vicious, because we aren't made in the same pattern. The last thing I want to know about any of you is your spiritual experiences, Frank, because maybe some of them you should never even repeat. As the Apostle Paul says, I was prohibited from saying anything about it. Remember? I was caught up into the third heaven, and I was not permitted to say anything. I can't put you under the law of my experience, in other words, Paul says. We're permitted to come in together in this wonder of a Christ for me. And there's the power of Luther. He never loses that. It's there. And then the happy exchange that you see, because when you see that Christ carries you, you're free to carry your brother. But when you still got to carry yourself, you haven't got time for anything else. And that's where he whams the Roman Catholic Church so hard on its side, because it wasn't free to carry the brother. It was so busy getting itself saved, see? And it had to go in special places to do it apart from the rest of humanity. Just now we got some hermits starting up again and so on. And the world's such a stink pot, I got to get out from it. And this is what we worry about this place being for anybody, an escape. It's not. It's a springboard, hopefully. A springboard into greater loving and greater awareness of where it's hurting. We can be part of the healing. And Luther's very wonderful on this, see. And that's where he's smashing Catholicism. But the greater brunt of his attack throughout most of his life becomes over against those who say, yeah, Luther came with the gospel, he didn't go far enough. We're bringing it further, see. And to all these emotionalizing experiences of it, and these enthusiasts, they call him, and he is just ram, ram, ram on it. Even though he never saw faith as something you pick up with your mother's milk, he never saw baptism as something you could say, oh, yes, I'm baptized, I'm in. You're excited about it, or you haven't seen it, you have been. See, it's there for you as your continual protection from Satan. And he proclaims baptism in a marvelous way, so it becomes gospel to you and not just a dim, distant something that happened somewhere, and somewhere I got a certificate proving it. But it's out of this wonder of the living Christ, and so there's continually in Luther this real thing. There's no false man of being upset, being up and down, not having it just all leveled off and always serene and always got it made. And that's a very real element, and we haven't seen Luther until we see that, because that creates part of the storm and stress of our modern period, and this whole risk-taking of it, and this whole fact that if you think you got it made, we're through, see? And none of that there is in Luther. He's exciting, and he opens up this passage into the modern age for the whole of Western society out of seeing that. The Holy Spirit who's continuing this struggle with man, he's never through with us. This man who just got the Nobel Prize from Germany in his play on Bertolt Brecht, putting on Coriolanus in Berlin, and I've quoted the passage before in German, it's just fantastic. It's one of the greatest perorations of modern stage in 20th century, unquestionably, because in the revolt, they've been in there and trying to get Brecht to join. Brecht says, the play's the thing, on with the play. And here these workers are out in the street actually carrying a fight for freedom that he says he had identified with communism before it, and he didn't want to face that. That's what communism didn't mean. And he wouldn't open his eyes and see it. Meanwhile, he has another beer. Finally, those six bottles are there staring at him, and they're pointing at him, and he's soliloquizing as he sees them, almost like they're firing at him. And he says, the Holy Spirit breathed, and I mistook it for a draft, and cried, who's come here to molest me? Something, huh? The Holy Spirit breathed, and I mistook it for a draft, and cried, who's come here to molest me? Because without sharing in the struggle, we're not with it. See? Faith isn't something that means, oh, I got faith. No, no struggle. No, we're continuing this human scene, and none of us are finished with it. And that's why we never through having to have somebody preach Christ into us. And Luther went to confession every morning, and old Bugenhagen shakes him one morning and says, Luther, believe the gospel. And Luther goes out saying, no, I know that Christ was speaking through Bugenhagen, see. Katie comes down to breakfast with Luther one morning, and she looks at his face, and she goes up, and she puts on her morning clothes, and she comes down again. And Luther looks at her, you crazy woman, what's wrong? Who's dead? She says, don't you know? God's dead. She says, lost your wits? No, she says, I looked at your face, Dr. Luther, and I realized God had died. And then he knew that Christ was speaking to him by Katie, you see. Well, this is a real thing. It's not some picture thing. It's all set out nice. It's a drama, and it's a mess, and it's in there. And Luther would have been 100% with old Lord of the Absurd Nogar and is presenting that to us. We're in the middle of a mess, and the thing is a mess, and that's why we need the plant superintendent so bad. If the plant were running nicely and you could have a nice little argument for God all the way along the line, you wouldn't need the superintendent, see. But you can't answer these questions in existence. We don't have the answers. What we got's a cross and a God crucified in his world that he created. And so Luther's full of those paradoxes. And we have the statement, you can't say the truth without two statements, see, that never sound like they can, you know, live with each other, but they have to live with each other because that's life. And it goes all down the line with Barthover works at a bit in his Romans back there. You can hardly read it, so full of paradox, but it's fun as he's trying and does succeed in restoring theology and Europe to once more being shaped by biblical witness to the Scriptures, Lord. And that's where Luther finds himself. He's exegeting. He's continually talking about the Scriptures, and that's why I want to close this day an introduction to him with that side of Luther. And I cannot find his preface to Romans. I am with you here today and not a professor at our seminary largely because I believe with all my heart that you cannot understand Luther without every time Luther says faith seeing Jesus Christ. Just got a little bit of fortification this morning from Rupp when he's quoting from the Articles of 36 that were written by Melanchthon that give a notion that faith is a new obedience. And Luther was furious about it, and he never bought this idea of faith as a kind of work on our part. poor Quanbeck can't see this. He threw Helsinki into a mess. He was the one that shaped up the original documents for it. Quanbeck and I have a war on this, and Quanbeck controls our seminary, and I'm not there. I'm a Missourian in our particular area. That's what they call me. Because I believe that faith is always identified with Jesus Christ and never apart from him, and that if faith is anything else but Jesus Christ, you've got something that's your own. You can brag about it. Then you can go along the street and say to somebody walking with us, I heard a guy doing on the streets of Denmark, I believe in God. And I was going to tell him, boy, God must be happy, Phil. You know. But until I am with our Lord, it's his faith that saves me, not mine. And Luther stuck a phrase in front of us that so we couldn't lose it, because he said, propter Christum, per fidem. The accent is always on Jesus Christ. You don't create faith by talking about faith that hasn't been done yet in this world. All I do is create despair. I send you looking for your faith, you're going to find a hole with hell at the end of it. I can tell you. All I have to do for any of you is do what one of my tricky profs did one time to us. And I tell you, did he spread despair and gloom fast? He says, for 24 hours, I just want you to keep track of all thoughts that come through your mind. Don't do it. I tell you, don't do it. We don't have a psychiatrist up here right now. And some of you might just simply fall, boom, like that. It's Christ who saves us. It's his intercession that is my confidence before him, isn't it, that we are taking for our meditation. And this is what Luther never lost sight of. So when he says in the don't do it. I tell you, don't do it. We don't have a psychiatrist up here right now. And some of you might just simply fall, boom, like that. It's Christ who saves us. It's his intercession that is my confidence before him, isn't it, that we are taking for our meditation. And this is what Luther never lost sight of. So when he says in the preface to Romans, oh, what a mighty active, busy thing is faith. Before you've asked, it has already been done, and so on. He goes on with a tremendous sweep, and it's lovely. And people quote it all over the place, and I can't find even the quote, and I can't find the preface to Romans in our books here, which is ridiculous. But this sounds like, you know, see, I got it. You don't. It's too bad, pal. You know? He means Christ. Christ through you. Christ in you. He's the one who is the doer. He's the one who is the uniter. He's the one who is hurting, so you enter into the hurt of the other. And he gives you this privilege of himself in the hurt of the other, as Barthas seems so beautiful in the prodigal son, for example. Who is it that the Samaritan runs into on the road lying there? Jesus Christ. And he's permitted in this guy that's been beaten up by the robbers to serve Jesus Christ. Of course that's right, isn't it? And it's the Christ in him who meets the Christ in the need and joins them, you see. This is what he's doing. He isn't just sitting there in the right hand of the Father, sucking his thumb until finally we get there. See? That's what he's doing for all this world, continually anew, for each of us. And that's why we can expect something to happen for us as we go along. But unlike the young Luther of 1517 in these particular lectures, and this is where the scholarship of the century just got off base, he's still tied in with his Roman Catholic background. He had, I think, when he started lecturing, he still had not had the experience. So there's a big argument just when it occurred. Catholics always like to have him sitting on the can when it happened, the clock, as it was. And there's nothing wrong to having a conversion in the toilet. My goodness. Well, the biggest one, I think he's the biggest financial contributor we've got right now, whom one of our great companies is now being in charge of its whole giveaway program in terms of everything it's doing for society, and it's a dandy. And he came running to his wife one morning because he didn't want to wake him. 5 o'clock in the morning, he's going to have to read the Bible because he's just tantalized by it. And he came running into her one morning, woke Anne up, and he said, it's speaking to me, it's speaking to me. See? Well, that's a good place to have it happen. And Luther suddenly saw that this business of trying to make God out of terror, and he puts it so well, if you make God out of scarecrow, you got a scarecrow for your God. That's the way Luther puts it. See? And this is what he'd been doing. The righteousness of God was something to terrify him. Suddenly saw the righteousness of God is that in which God gives himself to us. You see? And this was his conversion. Then he was marvelously warm. The Holy Spirit took him, he said, and it was an exciting moment. And it's an exciting moment for all of Western society, because just like that, everything fell apart that was holding man down all over the place. It crumbled with that insight Luther was given into the nature of God, as a God who gives himself to us in the forgiveness of sins. And everything gets tied up and centered in forgiveness and a God who's never through giving himself to us. So there's hope. And we don't have to despair for myself and for this world that is God's, in which he walked, on which he's been put on the cross. Luther sees that. But as he's lecturing Romans still, he's still got himself tied up with the old, you know, deal, and he's trying to free, and not all these things happen. Once he says, God justifies you in the light of what you are to become. That sounds awfully good. It saves ethics. It destroys you. You ain't loved right now. But shape up, guy. Come around. Get to be something, and I love you, see? And I'm loving you because you're going to shape up, see? Do you see it? Do you see the difference? Because it was really this is a real fog in 20th century scholarship. It was Kierkegaard from the 19th century that was used to clean that thing up. And Kierkegaard's an ethicist, if anybody ever has been, in the history of our church. But he saw, you can't destroy me to make me into an ethical being. And you've just destroyed me, because I'm not there unless God loves me the way I am now. It's hopeless. Let's give it up. See? And he said, this is the real Luther, and that's where Luther always spoke for the rest of his life, just because in the early lectures on Romans he gives vent to something. He takes it back and everything else says the rest of his life, which he does, see? Because that moment before God has to be continually protected from your being shattered, for no man can see God and live unless you know you're covered by God's gift of himself and the forgiveness of sins. That when he sees me, he sees Jesus Christ, and he says, my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. Otherwise, I'm going to consider myself unworthy of eternal life and walk away, as those Jews did, and we'll hear tomorrow. That has to be tomorrow's sermon. But I'll never feel I'm worth saving, see? My goodness. A gal that gave this place $7,000 in stock. We sold it now, so we got our $7,000 out of it now. We got what she gave to us. It's fine, it's come back up, and we sold it. But she tells me, when I was home now, this last time I went over to visit with her a little bit, and she said, wow. She said, if I lived 2 hours with you, I'd have allergic asthma the rest of my life. Poor Mary, you know. And then people have to live with me throughout all eternity. You know, it's kind of tough to inflict that. I remember Henry Bucher and I used to talk. He's called the Apostle of Hanoi, the island there out there. By Princeton, and he's a great guy. He's been one of our great football men in the back, back there. And we were talking one day. He's a little older in the mission field. I was. He already had 6 kids, and I hadn't been able to quite produce one yet. One coming. But he said, you know, I think God chooses us missionaries in order for the home church to be able to go on functioning peaceably. We're so ornery that he's got to get us out. And then again, sometimes I think he chooses us because we're so ornery we won't quit. But we're ornery. That's no question about that one. See. And this is how, when you look at yourself, how you see it. And that's why you have to be continually have Christ preached unto you, the gospel imposed unto you, and the knowledge that for my sake you're beloved. I call you by name, you're mine. And as we go down life's way, you'll hear that sermon pretty soon. He's coming in the middle of May. And I will be with you. I will hold you by your hand. I will call you by name, you are mine. There's Wes Preeb talking. See, between cigars. And it's you can't hear it enough. You can't hear it enough. See? That's why I can kind of have some fun with them right here, right now. Because can we hear it enough? As one guy says in prison camp when he suddenly wakes up to it, and he'd be our hero because he was our greatest scientist in prison and managed to save us on account of a couple of his little inventions, vitamin B out of rotten bananas and out of a weed making a malt that would pre-digest the carbohydrates so both he and I had sprue, we could stay through. He wouldn't be alive, neither would I, but for that. And Johnny, after sermon, says, you can't preach that enough because we never really believe it. And I tell him, John, now you know what faith is. That's what it is, isn't it? You can't preach enough because we never really believe it. And that's what Luther saw, and that's why it comes so strong from him, see? And it comes. He's never through with it. He doesn't feel you got time up there in the pulpit to do anything else. And I was a little shocked when I was a little kid. I was about 5 or 6, and we went back to my father's former parish. And he had a preacher in there who was then preaching against smoking. And a guy by the name of Steen, I can remember all this, from 5 years old, had just given him a new pipe, and he went up on a porch, and he smoked the pipe, blowing smoke in the face of this guy who was preaching against smoking in his pulpit, and he came out laughing heartily and said, ah, preach the gospel. I thought, well, you're just making that guy unhappy? But that's what you got to do sometimes to preach the gospel. You just don't have time for that stuff, see? Maybe some importance. Maybe a difference for some people dying of cancer, not cancer, for that matter. But it ain't what we're there for, see? And you don't waste time on it. I'm not sure this capitalist system should be anything that we start to bolster up and keep, but it's the only one I can live under right now. But I don't say that we've got to sanctify and baptize it and say, for this we go out and fight everybody in the world and we'll destroy everybody else and won't accept it. We've seen it can be the demon, the Satan that may be distorting, destroying everything. No system that I'm going to baptize. No kind of theory and science I'm going to baptize. That belongs to a concern for truth, and I hope if it's not so, some other guy's got enough guts and at least enough ego, so he wants to show his teacher wrong, and the minute students no longer want to show their teachers wrong, we're in a bad mess. Fortunately, that'll keep on going as long as there are students and teachers, and so they'll research stuff. This Vyshinsky, or whatever his name is right now, they're saying that maybe he isn't so stupid. He may be right after all. Gee, if he's right, we got to maybe join Missouri Synod in the world made in 6 days. Who knows? But there's some things. He's got some things in that crazy thing. Evidently, the moon trip proved out right. There's some things that come from the moon that may indicate some of his ideas are, you know, he's got Venus as a split off from Jupiter, and that's what causes a lot of those things about that time, and the plagues in Egypt, etc. And he goes through the whole cultures all over the place. At that time in China's is written, at that time in Malayans are written, and so on. You listen to the guy, and it kind of makes your head swim. But my cousin, who was at Yale at the time he was there, said it was the most thrilling moment in his 4 years at Yale, and he just simply stumped the fact. The fact they sat there, and they couldn't answer, just because he had information. Well, I'm not going over that. I don't say he's right. I just say he's interesting. See? Because that is not my concern in the gospel, see. I don't care how long the world's made. All I care is that God made it, and we've deserted the God who's made it, and he had to come into it and save us by being crucified for us in it. That's what I'm talking about, isn't it? And that's what Luther is. And that's what makes him so much fun. And he's alive to this hour. See? Very much. And controversial to this moment. Would he be happy about Jack Price? He'd smack Jack Price's head in. He would absolutely take and massacre him. He would say, Karlstadt is what Jack Price is. And boy, what he did to Karlstadt. In the prefaces there, if I had them here, I could go and read you. James, an epistle of straw. Revelation says, woe be unto him and destruction whoever tries to change anything in this book. Any of you understand any of it? So you can go ahead and change it? That's Luther of 1523. He can learn. He lives with it. He says, boy, I've been kicked around for a long time and writing these new prefaces. And he says, well, there's something good to be gotten from James. And maybe we need both him and Paul. And Revelations has been kept in our Bible because in times of great trial and temptation, has been a comfort to the church. Greek Orthodox churches have gotten along without it. They don't accept it but because they read Greek. But we live with it in spite of the fact we get screwballs that try to give us a blueprint for the future out of it. But since they make millions out of it, we got, at least they're not out on the government picking up our tax money to stay alive. Hal Lindsey and company. But it's got nothing to do with what's there. Because there is no blueprint. And that's what Luther would say. There's only one proper attitude for anybody in the future and thinking about the future, and that's agnosticism. Agnosticism means I don't know here at this point, because if the Son didn't know, how do we know? And there was one question asked this guy they wouldn't ordain right now. And all he did was to use what Jesus says. The times and the seasons are not given but to the Father. Acts 1. He just quoted the passage and they wouldn't ordain him just now. 2 weeks ago. What's his name? Who's here? Some of you know him. But the reason why they didn't ordain him wasn't because he was giving that answer. He was present student body when they walked out and went over to Aylin. Tragedy of Luther is to fall into the hands of the Lutherans. And if he were around, he'd sure be kicking some teeth off fast. Because that isn't there. We don't have that kind of security. We don't use the Bible in order to guarantee God. God guarantees God. Period. See? You see the difference? We don't have another idol alongside of it that's going to guarantee him. The church or a book. And Luther would be incisive at this point and say it. And when I was asked as a retreat with Missouri Synod pastors and their wives in Southern California, along with Mary, I thought, oh, you're trying to put me up there on that tree already, and I barely got going. Because I said about 20 words, and one man said, what's your idea of inspiration? I said, okay, I'm telling you guys, that's what I tell my own. When you start entering into God's business, you've just left me. That belongs to him, and I refuse to be guilty of his majesty of trying to intrude upon God's mystery of the way he gives himself to us. That's his business. Good for you, that's why I see it, he said, too. As I lived around amongst you Norwegians so long that I've become part of the church, and now Jack Price wants to send me back to a sect. Then he tried to tell his little story about it, how he went to the Concordia College choir concert because he had a parish in Moorhead.
Buddy said, I didn't sing the hymns, no unionism. I just went and listened to the music. Buddy says, the next year, he says, I found myself singing the hymns. And then he went on to the story. Then he went to Hibbing, and he says, who calls me up when I come into town? Joe Stoll. He says, come on over, we've got dinner ready for you. Well, he happens to be another one of those offhand cousins I got in the ministry. But that was a great experience for him. And he says, I got to be made into a sect again. You see? Luther did not allow the church to become a sect. It never is. The name Lutheran is given to us by our enemies, just like the name Christian is given to us by our enemies. We're the evangelical Catholic Church, and we're open and wide open to all who respond to this gospel. And this is where you'll have to see him. And then he's at Marburg, and then I'm going to close here because this is too much to go on with all this. But he's at Marburg. And this is a moment when the Catholics have armed. They've got a league. There's going to be war. When you can't win by argument, and Aleander's already said, we can't pay people to read our books, and as fast as we burn Luther's, they're printing more. Never made a buck by him. But he made a lot of millionaires. Printers all over the place have made millions on him, literally. So, if you can't beat the guy with arguments, you got to beat him. Knock his teeth out. And that's what they're going to do. And Luther still refuses to come to the sword. He says, no, truth cannot be descended by the sword. It must rather be put on the cross. Well, at least meet with Zwingli so we get everybody together and we're not divided. So they sit there at Marburg around there, and Luther writes in the dust, hoc est corpus meum, right in front of him, leaves that on the table. I have thought in times of my life, gee, couldn't you have been less stubborn then? Maybe we could have come together some way. Zwingli sits over that way. So I asked Baynton last summer. Baynton is not a Lutheran. He's a Luther scholar, but he's not a Lutheran. He's got nothing to protect, no tradition, no background, no dad who is a Lutheran minister, and he hasn't been ordained one himself. So there's nothing to protect from Baynton. I said, how do you feel about that situation? Oh, no question about it. You save Western society. He says, what if you'd gone along with Zwingli? We would have become Greeks, and then we wouldn't be anymore. Hoc est corpus meum. He saved this materialism of the Hebrew world that the Greek mind has never sent it to. The more spiritual you are, the more you spell it S-P-I-R-I-T-U-E-L-L-E, and you'll finally join the Christian Science Church, where you'll now partake of Holy Communion in spiritual ways. You're sitting there in your seat, and you'll think on the body and blood of Christ, and you're having communion. We'll now pass the collection plate, and I said, Mary, I've never been to one. Mary was there when this happened. I said, I sure hope you gave them a spiritual offering. She said, I did. Okay. But that's where you end up, you see. This is Christ's body. It makes your body the temple of God. It makes the body of your civilization part of God's concern for you and for your good now. For it's the promise of the life that now is as well as the one to come. It keeps our feet on the earth. It keeps us with a hope that's earthy. And you know, the Bible, it's a crazy book. It begins where? In heaven? No. On earth? And where does it end? With us getting up to heaven? No. What happens to heaven? It comes down to what? Where's the Bible in? Read the 20th, 21st chapters. It comes down to earth, doesn't it? A new heaven and a new earth. And it's always a materialistic hope. For we are shaped by the word made, what? Spirit? All right, I hope so. I hope you heard it. And that's what Luther fought for all the way through. What a terrific guy. And never a dull moment, I can assure him. Sure he's worthy. But so what? Who of us aren't when you're excited about something? I've been too wordy now. But it's an introduction, and have fun with it. These materials are here for you to read. And it's fun just to pick up some of his sermons, if you want to make that one of your tutorials. That's the least known part of Luther and the most fun. You can read, if you want to, people were around. They made loads of money on it, by the way. They'd come in, and his wife knew it. She had a little sense for buck, and she was mad as hop. Making money off your Luther, they even, when you're there and there, they hear you with the toilet paper, and they got a remark that you were making right in there on the sharpness, and it's down here. You know, he never got away from them. It's like up here where you get tape, whatever you do. There they had somebody taking the notes. And so Luther's table talk is fun. You hear him off the record on this, that, and the other thing. But don't go too much by it because, gee, when a guy's just gotten a little rough deal from his wife, he may say something a little different than he might after he thought it through a little bit. So that's just Luther off the cuff all the time. But you've got him even that way. And you've got reams. How many is it? It's going to be in English? 58 volumes?
Does it take four?
54 volumes. Nobody expects you to read through that stuff for a Lutheran tutorial, I assure you. But read a few sermons and just see how much fun he is. Only the dark black preachers preach that way in our America. They got the gumption to do it, and they got a congregation that expects it. And they'd be unhappy they came to church and they hadn't. But you discover that they do go to church to have some fun. And it isn't like one of our preachers was saying one morning, he sort of felt defensive because the preacher was asking that I had those Pentecostal Sunday nights still in church as well as Sunday morning. Boy, we had a great time in our church last night. Have any fun in yours? Any fun in mine? The last time I think they had any fun was when I didn't know whether I'd said the apostolic benediction at the end or not, so I had him rise up again for it. And I said, no, I have said it, so I had him sit down again. I said, no, I didn't, so I had to come up. And he said, the boy in the front was going. Any questions, though, on any of this now that you'd like to hear, just for further clarification? Because the gospel is exciting, and wherever it is, there should be a delight that we ain't all made the same, and we're not always getting along beautifully, and we're certainly going to have times when we just don't communicate. And isn't it wonderful that the Word made flesh is communicating on both sides, and He'll do all things well, and He ever lives to make intercession for us. And He's not through with it. Look what He's done with the Church of Rome in these last decade, and Luther never kicked the Church of Rome. He kicked the Pope, he kicked the monks, but he didn't kick the people of God. And he says, the gospel is always there, and I want none of my people ever to impose themselves upon them, to preach the gospel amongst them only by invitation. We don't proselyte, and we never have. And we rejoice in the Christ that's big enough to get through a very small opening, even if it's just in the Mass in Latin, to behold the Lamb of God that takes away the sin of the world. And how many Roman Catholics have just heard that much gospel and have had all the gospel they needed. Remember the woman at the Samaritan, woman at the well? And the Jews had no dealings with the Samaritan. They only had the first five books of Moses. But she knew enough to say, I know when the Messiah comes, He will tell me these things. That's more than some of us have had a lot of training in the Catechism and New Testament know when we listen sometimes to Jesus, don't we? This is the Messiah. The one given by God to be our opening to the mystery of life and to what the world is like and what God is like who created it. A God who's hurting. Think if He were Aristotle's God, the unmoved first mover, and Zwingli had won. You see? He wouldn't be. We would be destroyed. No longer be. So Melanchthon is right. Luther hanging tight. And so, okay, we lose the wars. God will raise up another Luther. He's nothing. He will not let His gospel die. But oh boy, it can lie dormant sometimes, can it? And it sure can be permitted even to be made to look, as Dorothy Sayers said, sentimental and tedious. And when the theologians manage to do that to the most exciting event that's on this earth, that the Word has become flesh, that God has become man, it's time that a detective writer and a woman takes up the cudgels and writes some theology. And boy, it's good theology and exciting. And as she says, when did orthodoxy ever become dull? Thinking straight is the most exciting thing you can do. And so she writes, Creed or Chaos. Creed or Chaos. What a book. And it's out of this encounter with the gospel and Luther that we in the Western society know this relationship of excitement to life. Not of cynicism, not of defeatism, but of excitement. Any comments? You see why why we speak of Luther. Not in any way to impose him on any of you. You can let him go. He won't mind. But you sure miss a lot. Any questions that came to you while reading of Galatians as you were with it now through Lent? Okay, that's enough for this morning. It gives us a little taste to give our day some content.